It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Good morning. Now that more and more baby boomers are caring for aging parents, their employers are starting to notice. Juggling a full-time job and a parent's end-of-life care can be extremely challenging. Judy Martin reports on the ways some big companies are trying to help, and she began at a support group sponsored by one.
I want to find just the right word. Words that say what's in here.
A dozen people watch a film while eating lunch in a dimly lit corporate training room. It's a caregiver support group at the global headquarters of Connecticut-based mailing giant Pitney Bowes.
You see, I have been diagnosed with a dementia.
The movie ends. Conversation ensues. Employee Sandra Durant brings up her recent experience with her dad.
He can't remember if he ate breakfast, but he can tell you anything that happened in 1956 or any of those years, he's fine with it. And it hurts so bad, you know, but we reach out to him. We take
Pitney Bowes is now reaching out to its employees beyond caregiving concerns to end-of-life issues. It's offering employee assistance programs like financial and legal resources, counseling on hospice and palliative care, and flexible working arrangements. Dr. Brent Pawlecki, Pitney Bowes medical director, says before the baby boomer exodus that will leave a big hole in the workforce, it's best to hold on to them.
If the employer is responsive to the needs of the employee, you're going to have a much more loyal and engaged employee for a longer period of time. And so it really will help with retainment, recruitment, and employers can become an employer of choice that really makes it easier to attract good talent.
A report by the National Alliance for Caregiving and AARP found one in five caregivers had to take a leave of absence from work. Now consider the dying process in those critical months prior to death. Employee productivity becomes dicey at best. Dr. David Ballard heads up the American Psychological Association's Healthy Workplace Program.
At times where their concentration may be impaired, they may be distracted by all of these issues they're dealing with. Clearly, they may be physically present at work, but not be working up to their full potential.
To help such employees, Pitney Bowes launched a pilot program last fall allowing flexible working arrangements. It's been crucial for employee Marianne Fulgenzi. She was given all the tools she needed to work mostly from home while taking care of her elderly mom.
That has been an absolute lifesaver for me because it enables me to take my mom to medical appointments, to handle things around the house that need to be done during the day, to watch over the care that she gets. I can get my work done at any time of the day or night and be very successful.
It is to begin a conversation, to encourage a conversation.
Fulgenzi joined the caregiver support group. She's used online tutorials for end-of-life legal issues and says she feels supported by her managers. Pitney Bowes, along with GE, PepsiCo, and IBM, is working with the National Business Group on Health to design an end-of-life toolkit for employers. This kit will help caregivers and employees who have been given a life-limiting diagnosis. Addressing the topic is a business imperative, says Stephen Kiernan. He's the author of Last Rites, Rescuing the End of Life from the Medical System.
It's not something that employers are going to have the option of dealing with. It's a question of if they can respond to it before it gets ahead of them, or they begin to lose good employees, or to have huge costs because employees are out of work taking care of mom or dad.
Stephen Kiernan says companies should talk about end-of-life issues because it's one of those things where the humane can really align with the bottom line. For NPR News, I'm Judy Martin in New York.
A year and a half ago, with the economy in the early stages of what promised to be a huge recession, the Obama administration decided to test out the advice of a man who had been dead for over 60 years, economist John Maynard Keynes. Keynes had argued that a government can pull a country out of recession by spending money, a lot of money. The stimulus plan passed by Congress pledged to do that with $787 billion. Now economists are looking back and trying to see if this big experiment actually worked. David Kestenbaum and Alex Bloomberg of our Planet Money team have this report.
The stimulus bill that passed was 1,000 pages long, but we right here, Alex, are going to reduce it to a very, very short radio drama.
I will be playing the role of the U.S. government, which means I get to spend $787 billion.
You don't get to just create the money out of thin air.
Yeah, you're right. I have to borrow it. So I'm going to issue treasury bonds, basically say, loan me money, and I will pay you back with interest.
Okay, so begin drama.
Got some bonds here. Any takers?
Yeah, I'll buy the bonds.
Really? Who are you?
I'm everyone. I'm the guy down the street investing money for retirement. I'm a rich oil sheik in the Middle East. I'm the Chinese government.
Well, geez, thanks, everybody. Now I have $787 billion to spend. And scene.
So the idea that this scheme can haul a country out of a recession may seem a little strange.
After all, I, the government, am borrowing money from people who already have it. Why not just let those people spend it?
Because they are not spending it. And this was Keynes's big idea. That economies don't always bounce back as quickly as they might because people and companies aren't spending the money they have. So governments have to borrow the money from them and spend it for them. Mark Zandi is chief economist with Moody's Analytics.
The idea is that people get nervous, they pull back on their spending, that causes businesses to lose sales, they fire more people, that causes consumers to pull back even more, and you get in this self-reinforcing cycle downward. And that, I think, is a pretty good description of what we were in just a little over a year ago.
Mark Zandi was a fan of the stimulus. And a year and a half ago, when this old economic idea that a government could spend its way out of a recession was suddenly dusted off and debated in Congress, we called economists of all stripes to see what they thought. Many supported the idea or thought it was worth a shot.
But not everyone. Tyler Cowen of George Mason University is not a Keynesian. But back then, he did tell us he was open to being converted.
If we spend $700 billion and the economy recovers within a year, year and a half, I would take that as serious evidence that my view is wrong. I don't think it will happen, but I would take it seriously.
That is rare for someone to say, maybe I'm wrong. Call me back in a year and a half.
It has been a year and a half, so we called him back, and
Tyler Cowen does not think he was wrong.
If you just look at the actual outcome, I would say what we did didn't work.
The economy has been growing for about a year, but unemployment is still high, and Cowen thinks the economy might be turning down again, a double-dip recession.
Stimulus, for sure, it works in the short run. The thing is, what happens when you pull the stimulus away? If you simply slide back to where you were, all you've done is postpone that process of adjustment, and I think that's what we're seeing. So I view it as a kind of short-term fix that gave us some stabilizing properties but didn't really turn the economy around.
Turn the economy around. That was Keynes's idea, that spending could restart the economic engine. So it wouldn't just for years.
Mark Zandi, who supported the stimulus, has not changed his mind either. He thinks it has worked, that the car has started. More like a boom, boom, boom.
I don't think it's a coincidence that the recession ended just about this time last year when the stimulus was providing its maximum economic benefit. So it achieved its principal objective, to arrest the recession and jumpstart an economic recovery, and it succeeded.
He admits, though, there will be a penalty down the road.
This cost us dearly. If you add up all of the stimulus that we provided to the economy, it was $1 trillion, or roughly $1 trillion. I mean, that's very, very costly, and we're going to have to pay for it.
Pay for it by cutting spending or raising taxes, and this really is the crux of the debate. Cowen and Zandi agree that a giant stimulus package can help the economy in the short run, and they agree there's a cost down the road. It's a question of which is larger.
So, Dave, are we saying that a year and a half after doing this national experiment, we still don't have an answer?
No, we have an answer. We have two answers. They just contradict each other.
We asked Mark Zandi and Tyler Cowen, okay, if we check in with you guys again later, what would convince you you were wrong and the other guy was right?
Tyler Cowen said if the economy bounces back strongly in the coming years, he'd have to wonder if Keynes was onto something.
Mark Zandi says if the debt from all the spending seems to really weigh down the economy, he'd have to wonder if maybe Keynes was wrong all along. I'm Alex Blumberg.
And I'm David Kestenbaum, NPR News.
For retailers, this back-to-school period is the second most important selling season of the year after Christmas. And early reports are not especially encouraging. Stores reported weaker than expected sales in July, just as families started their back-to-school shopping. From Seattle, NPR's Wendy Kaufman has more.
With their school's recommended shopping list in hand, Sunny Elgar and her 5-year-old son Park are making their way through this immense Target store in North Seattle.
Glue sticks. Check. One backpack. 12 sharpened pencils. Check.
And that wasn't sanitizer. All they bought. Earlier in the day, Elgar bought her son a small selection of new clothes at a value-priced retailer and...
new shoes.
And we got some pants and a jacket, some shirts. It seemed to be very expensive today, even when we went to the cheap place and didn't buy all that much as far as clothing.
The basic school supplies alone quickly add up.
I had to get a protractor and a compass.
Kellum and her mother, Lisa Alm, were also tallying the bill.
Two girls in elementary schools, over $100, and we didn't even get everything.
In fact, a recent survey from the National Retail Federation suggests that American families plan to spend, on average, about $600 on back-to-school shopping for their kids in grades K through 12. That's about 10% more than last year. But remember, 2009 was a dismal year for retailers. And based on relatively weak July sales, those numbers may prove to be overly optimistic. Ellen Davis is a vice president at the National Retail Federation.
The economy is still impacting spending in a tremendous way. We're not seeing people walk into the stores and buy items right away. They might go home and look for a coupon.
Or wait until the item goes on sale. In short, consumers are being deliberate. After looking at items online, Debbie Keenan and her college-bound daughter, Molly, put together a realistic budget before setting foot in a big box store.
Dad's actually unemployed, so we're sticking to our budget pretty carefully.
I tried to get the things that were on sale, tried to decide if it's something that you actually need or not.
Did you pick up anything and then say, this one's too expensive?
Yeah, a couple times.
But while consumers remain cautious, the Retail Federation says that unlike last year, many shoppers are now saying they care about more than just the lowest price. They're looking for quality and value as well. Allison Paul, who heads the retail practice at the consulting firm Deloitte, says their recent consumer survey also offered a glimmer of hope for retailers. But she added,
you know, the number one destination continues to be discount stores. And a good two-thirds of consumers said they would only spend using cash and debit cards.
If there were any real surprises in the consumer survey data, it may be this. The Retail Federation's Ellen Davis says college men are relatively big spenders.
We all think that, you know, college guys are going to school with maybe a new laptop and, you know, whatever their mom has packed from the kitchen. That's not the case this year. College guys are spending much more than college women on every single category.
Why? Davis says we can only speculate. Perhaps men are feeling more confident about the economy, or perhaps they are just less willing to spend the time to shop for the best deal. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Seattle.
The job market is also grim for the nation's teenagers. New figures released yesterday by the Labor Department show that unemployment rates inched down in July, but overall, the jobless rate for 16 to 19-year-olds is the highest on record for any summer since 1948. More than one in 14 job seekers can't find work. They're facing more competition from out-of-work adults and recent grads who can't find work in their fields. NPR's Carolyn Beeler reports that it might be a lean fall for students returning to school.
Justin Brown is one of the lucky ones. This summer, he's operating an old wooden roller coaster at a Six Flags amusement park in Maryland.
Thank you guys so much for riding the wild one. Push down, pull up on your lap bar.
17-year-old Brown had work experience at the park, and that's what helped him get hired again.
I worked here last year, same job, in rides, and I really like it here. It's a fun atmosphere.
At this Six Flags, job applications by adults increased by almost 25% over last year in the lead-up to the summer season. Some of the jobs that used to go to teenagers are now going to people like Margaret Cole, who's taking tickets at the entrance to the park.
Hello, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good, thank you.
4 out of 5 of the greeters working the turnstiles are, like her, older adults. 2 years ago, Cole left a federal job for medical reasons. She had held it for 24 years. But now she's back in the job market and unable to find a good-paying job.
I can do this until something better comes for me. You know, you have a job and you make your ends meet wherever you can.
Older adults who were laid off are increasingly applying for jobs that used to be entry-level positions. so are college grads who can't find work in their fields. Andrew Sum is the director for the Center for Labor Market Studies at Northeastern University, a left-leaning research and policy group. He says the employment rate for teens has been declining for the past decade, but this summer it's the worst since the government started tracking the numbers in 1948.
We are doing a lot worse than we had even projected we'd be doing, and it looks like this summer will be record new low employment rate for the nation's young people.
Sum says typically it's easier for teens who live in small towns to find jobs. Employers are more likely to hire a teenager if they know and trust their families.
Kids who live in small towns, employers are much more trusting of young kids, think they ought to work, know them, and will hire them. I know Andy because his dad shops at my store.
But that's not working for everyone in this economy. Melissa Copaz is an 18-year-old who lives in Crestview, Florida.
It's a really, really small town in Florida, so there's more competition for the jobs there.
Copaz spent the beginning of her summer driving around to fast food restaurants submitting job applications. She worked at Pizza Hut last summer, so she has experience. What she didn't have was any luck.
It's completely ridiculous because I need a job. I'm going to college. I need to be able to pay for my books and stuff. And scholarships only get you so far.
Copaz has given up on finding a job for this summer. Her scholarship covers her tuition, but she says she'll have to cut back on summer fun so she can afford her books this fall. Carolyn Beeler, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News.